The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Noah.
Thank you. Thanks. Hey, everybody. I'm Noah. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 16th, 2010. Atlantic Group is my home group. I have a sponsor. I work the steps. And I try and, you know, do service when I'm asked to. I'm really, really grateful to be here tonight and to see all you guys. I want to thank Deb for asking me to speak. I want to thank my sponsor for, like, just giving me a really good template of how to be a better person. And God, because, you know, that's where I'm at today. Hey, Mom, I made it. No, she's just kidding. She's not here. But that's actually, my dad should be somewhere. So I don't know if that's it. But I don't think he's here yet. He's running late. Runs in the family. But I will say, like, that's actually a very weighted statement, you know, for me to say that. Like, because I wasn't supposed to. I wasn't supposed to make it. You know, I had doctors, therapists, family members, friends, astrologers, and tell me that I wasn't supposed to make it, you know, and unless I changed my behavior, I was gonna die a lot earlier than, you know, maybe I would have otherwise. And what happened to me was that I didn't have to, my behavior was changed for me. I'll just share a little briefly. So I grew up in Westchester. Nice Jewish boy, great parents, good family, you know, had friends, you know. I was nervous and a little anxious, but, you know, I got through it, you know. And I had my first drink, I should say, when I was about 7 or 8. My dad had owned a bar, and I remember it was the idea of, like, sneaking something, you know. It was exciting to me, and so I snuck a bottle of Zima. I don't know if you guys remember Zima, but I remember it tasting really good and being warm on the way down, and that was the end of it. You know, I didn't drink again for like another 4 or 5 years. But again, it was really the atmosphere that, like, surrounded the situation that was exciting for me. You know, not the actual alcohol itself. And for me, it was like I wanted to be cool, you know, and I chased cool, like, almost to death's doorstep, you know. That was, like, just the way it went for me. And so, you know, when my friends started drinking, like, Old English and 40 ounces of, like, Colt 45 and stuff like that, I was like, man, can't we just drink Zima? Like, it tastes so much better, you know? And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to do what, like, you know, Wu-Tang Clan was doing and that stuff. And so that was what I did. And I held my nose and I chugged it and I tried to do it, you know, twice as hard as everybody else. And then that's exactly what I did. And my disease progressed real quick, you know. By the time I was 16, 17, I was hanging out with the older kids doing stuff I never thought I was going to do. I was like a proud student of the DARE program. I don't know if you guys remember that. It, like, taught me, like, not to drink and drive. It taught me to, like, you know, not do other substances. And like, I did everything. You know, I was the guy that, like, would leave my house sober without my car keys and say, okay, we have to have a designated driver tonight, guys. And then I would get drunk, and then I'd go home and get my car, you know? And, like, that was what alcohol did for me. It just made me feel like I could do anything, you know? And so I chased it. And I was a blackout drinker. A lot of my story, like, I'll try and remember, you know, certain parts, but it's really just, you know, I don't remember. I don't really remember. Woke up a lot in my parents' driveway with cars missing. You know, just chunks of time gone, and I don't know what went down. So I'm really lucky to be here. I remember coming out of blackouts, like going through a red light with a car full of people, waking up, you know, in a pile of snow outside of a club with a guinea tee on, and like just not knowing what happened. And like that was the nature of that was how things went for me. And so. Just fast forward a little bit, like, so what happened, you know, towards the end was I had been with a girl, toxic relationship, moved out west to try, like, to start over, and I did. You know, I left everything behind, and for 2 weeks, like, life was looking really good. And, you know, within 2 months, like, I was getting evicted from an apartment. I was living with a call girl who had two kids, and you know, and my friends were like that lived there were like doing an intervention. My face gets really red when I qualify. I'm sorry. I'm just really passionate. So my friends were doing an intervention on me, and like that's just what happened in 2 months. You know, I had no coping mechanisms for life. I had no way to deal with life on life's terms. And so I started going to my first like round of treatment centers. The gig was pretty much up in early 2010. My parents kind of knew what the deal was. They wanted me to like, you know, pass like, you know, urine tests at home if I wanted to stay. I said, well, I'm not doing that. So I left and I moved all my stuff into my car, and that's where I lived for the next 6 months. And tried to crash on friends' couches. They didn't want me anymore. And so I literally would just sleep in my car. And, you know, things got really dark. You know, I will say that it got to the point where I had nowhere to go. I had no money left. I was stealing from everybody I knew. My body was emaciated. I had progressed to doing stuff I never thought I would do. I had track marks up and down my arms and legs, and I was ready to die. And I didn't want to get sober. I really did not want to get sober. I had no interest. I wanted to figure it out. That was my like call phrase. I was like, I'll figure it out. And I remember being underneath a bench in Bronx Central Booking, and I turned to my left, and there was a pile of crumbs that was just this high. It was all like the sandwiches that the inmates were throwing underneath. And my feet smelled so bad that like these guys wanted to jump me in the cell. And that's just, and that was like what my life had come to. And when I got out, I still did the same thing. And finally, you know, I had surrendered to a degree, and I was ready to do something for a little while differently. So I went to this treatment center. It was a 200 men homeless shelter upstate. And I started this journey, and I didn't want to do it, but I did it. And I'm the guy that like doesn't want to do stuff, but does it anyway, and I still get the benefit, you know, or has the wrong motives for doing things and does it anyway, and still gets the result. I was praying for the wrong reasons. I'm Jewish. Everybody else there was Christian and Catholic, and I wanted to be. They were saying prayers. I wanted to say prayers, so I started saying Jewish prayers. And like, but it was a connection. It was an opportunity for me to do something a little bit differently. And that's what started my journey with prayer. And then, you know, I got out of there, and people, they were like, "Oh, I'm just going to go back home and start things again. Get the girl, get the car, get the family, get the job, everything back." And no, you can't come home. So I went to a halfway house in East Harlem, and luckily I had nothing else to do but go to meetings, because literally I didn't have anything else to do. So I met my sponsor at the Mustard Seed, and he was like, "Why don't you come to this meeting?" And I finally saw that, like, I could maybe do this for a little while. And mind you, I had like charges pending against me. Like, that was the only reason I was staying sober. You know, I didn't really think that my life would had a different direction. I had already planned out the way that it was going to go. I was going to just be left alone, figure it out, and if I died early, like, that was okay. And slowly, things started to change for me. And I went through the steps, and I started living life a little bit differently. And I started to see that, like, a lot of the ideas, the old ideas that I had, I was wrong. I was wrong about the way that I thought I had to operate in the world. I was wrong about the way that I thought everybody else around me had to operate. And I was able to kind of take a step back and just have an opportunity to be a little bit more humble. Even though I thought I was, like, the nicest, most humblest guy in the world, but obviously I had a lot to learn, and I had to have a lot of experiences of discomfort. And that's the way my life is today. You know, and it's not all amazing, and I don't do this perfectly. You know, I wish people would say when I started coming around, you know, life beyond your wildest dreams. And I really had, like, I'm a very imaginative person, and I like was able to really paint this incredible picture for myself. And I was like, man, I get 1 year of this thing, like, my life is going to, and like, it didn't, like, it didn't change that much. But what changed was on the inside. And I had a peace of mind, thank you, and I had a peace of mind that was like nothing I had ever experienced before. And I started having real relationships with people for the first time, and there wasn't anything like, oh, I'm going to get this thing from this person, I'm going to manipulate and just take whatever I can from my family or whoever's willing to give it to me. Like, and I was able to like just show up for life in a new way, and it was really rewarding on a very deep level. And so that's what I have to like offer today is like, you know, I'm the guy that was supposed to die. I'm the guy that was supposed to like not get this thing and like not, certainly wasn't doing it for the right reasons. And like I did it anyway and it worked, you know? And so, you know, I just have to say that like AA works in spite of itself. Like if you're here, you're already doing something right, you know? And, thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Angela.
Jane, where are you? There you go. Hi, I'm Angela, alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 16, 2013, and I have a sponsor, Jane P., and I've worked the steps. I'm so glad to be here. I really, really, really am. I'm going to be your emotional one. You know, I was just, every day I wake up because the odds are that I'm not gonna make it. You know, I'm a year and a half sober, but the odds are one day I'm gonna call Jane up and say, you know what, I'm not gonna make the meeting today. I'm not gonna make it. I got something to do. My kids, thanks for the memories, Jane. I'm not going to do this program anymore. You know, I mean, the odds are that that's what I'm going to do one day, and I have to wake up every morning and remember that, and I do. I'm on my knees in the morning. God, please keep me sober today, because I wasn't the kind of drunk that was going to make it, that wasn't going to stay alive. And I'll start my story out a little later on in my story in January of 2013. I'm sure some of you can understand this, but I'm trying to understand some parts of my childhood that I haven't gotten free of yet. So, you know, where I started in January of 2013, I had sold my house, lost my car, lost my job. My husband had left me, and my kids were distracted. I was barely taking care of them. My sister had moved in to take care of my two children for me, because I was barely doing it. And that was the beginning of my bottom. That was the beginning. And that's so hard to remember. But it, you know, it. That year went on, and there was like a switch that flipped. It was like heavy drinking for a long time, and then it went to like this blur, you know? Like I didn't know what day it was. I didn't know where I was supposed to be. A calendar, I couldn't get through my calendar. I didn't know when to pick my kids up at school. I didn't know where my kids were gonna be. And all I could do was think about where my next drink was gonna be and how I was gonna get there. And I had a few lucid moments through those next 9 months. I remember briefly, at the same time I had a gambling problem, so that's another outside issue, but I love to bet on football. I don't do it anymore, but I'm in the finance industry, and it was one of the things that I really loved to do. Sundays, betting on football, getting there at 11. I had my games all lined up for the day. And that was I could drink the whole day. But, you know, I had a few lucid moments in those 9 months, and one of them was waking up on a casino bus headed to Atlantic City, and I had two empty, tall beers or whatever. I don't know what it was. And someone tapping me and saying, are those your kids? And they were. And I had passed out on the bus. I didn't know how I was going to get them into the casino, but there was another moment, you know, and this is a real cry line for me, because I don't know who was taking care of my children at the time, but they were in the hallway of my house, and I sort of remember someone, my little one, saying, can mommy come out with us today and play? And somebody in the background saying, she's not feeling well. She's not feeling well. and my face was plastered to a pillow, and I couldn't even move. I couldn't move. I wanted to move. I wanted to get up and play with them so bad, but I couldn't. I couldn't move. And then my health started to go, and that was some of the other moments. And really, you know, it's amazing the thing that I came in on. The bottom of my legs had swollen so bad that I could barely walk. And in my head, I had rationalized it that I couldn't wear high heels, so I needed to stop drinking. Like, I could no longer get out to the club in my high heels, so, like, you know, maybe I got to take it easy for a while. And that's, you know, that was the only thing that clicked. You know, that's very selfish, but that's what did it. And and I had some people around me. My sister had moved in, and you know, every morning I'd come home, and at 6 a.m. or whatever, or when I would finally make it home, and the phone would be, "Where are you? Where are you? The kids want to see you," and this and that. And I finally got some help. Some people around me sort of led me to a meeting. I ended up going to the mustard seed and counting days, and the mustard seed. You know, I thought it was the only meeting in the city. I really didn't know, and I have to thank all of you. There's a lot of people in this room and a lot of people who I've met along the way. I mean, I was the person who sat on the outside. When people would ask me to go to a meeting, I was so thankful because I was so scared to go by myself. And there was a woman who called me every day for 90 days, and I never picked up the phone, but I listened to every message, and I was so grateful for that. And one of the women that I had met brought me to an Atlantic Group meeting on Sunday night, and at the time I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't really, you know, I was just sort of learning as I went, and I was a little later on in my sobriety, about 4 months sober, and brought me up to Jane, and I ended up being in so much pain at that time because I hadn't worked any steps that I called her at 6 a.m. the next morning, and she picked up the phone. She picked up the phone, and I said, "I need a sponsor," and she said, "Okay, let's do it," you know, and I was just so grateful because at that point, we didn't start the steps. I mean, we launched into the steps. I mean, it was rigorous. It was work. It was honest. I mean, we did it. We worked hard, and she worked hard with me. And the harder I worked, the harder she worked. And if I would back off, you know, she would pick me back up. And you know what? She would move a mountain to work with me. Even if her schedule didn't fit it, she would fit it in. And that's what sponsorship is. I mean, that changed my life. And we worked the steps. We went through, you know, God, may you find him now. May you find him now. She helped me see every place in my life where I have already been saved. And that was such an amazing occurrence to me because I hadn't seen it before. I just needed someone to point it out to me. And 4 was really hard for me. I didn't feel a ton of relief from it because I felt a lot of shame from being a mother and not taking care of my children properly. But I did find a lot more relief in the amends and in my living amends to my kids. I mean, that has been the biggest change in my life. It started out with showing up on time, you know, getting to school on time, going to parent conferences, just the little things. And, you know, that was a big change in my whole sobriety. And I want to share with you some of the things that that have changed as a result of working these steps that have been such a miracle. My daughter was born with a brain disorder, and I lived in a Ronald McDonald House when she was born, and I basically kind of gave up on her on the 9 months when I was really, really sick and drinking, and I just didn't know what else to do. And she was in a special ed class when I met Jane, and today she moved into an integrated kindergarten, this year, integrated kindergarten. And I want to tell you that She got better because I got better. It's not what she did or anything changed for her. It's because I got better. And that's the amazing thing about this program is, like, the ripples we create know no boundaries. And I owe my life to my sponsor. I really, really do. Because she was the mother of my kids for the last year and a half. She was the one who got me there and got me up and got me somewhere on time. And little by little, I'm taking it back and doing it on my own. But she was the mother. And I thank her for that every second, because my kids are thriving, my daughter is thriving, and I'm just so lucky to have everyone in this room, because it's really true family, true family. So thank you. Thank you.